We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many Alpha men and women in this room tonight, listening later on alphaclub.org, desperately need, will hear our speech tonight. We believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight we've got Melvin. I just noticed on the flyer that had a typo. You've been sober since 1989. I guess that's a marketing deal. 1989 is, that's a good long time. I'm in my fourth year. I can only imagine all the things that Melvin has accomplished. I heard him tell a story at this year's Wing Dang Doodle. And I have to tell you what, he is one Wing Dang Doodle of a speaker. And I hope he brought it with him tonight. So please welcome Melvin.
That's a lot of pressure. Hey everybody, my name is Melvin. I'm a work recovering alcoholic. Amen. And by God's grace and mercy, I'm clean soul today. This is kind of a challenge for me. You know, every now and then we come to places like this, and I come to places like this, and I go, I'm a 12 and 12 thump. I'm really into the 12 and 12, the attitudes, thinking, and behavior stuff. And you get a chance to go through the theory of recovery and the theory of living, and then every now and then we get an opportunity to go live. So I'm going live. Because one of the S's, one of my S's are out of whack. You know, that sex, society, and security they talk about in the 12 and 12. The relationship stuff. My dog got shot. My girl, you know, love and logic don't necessarily know each other. You understand? Anyway, that's another meeting. Anyway. What about again? What it was like, what happened, and how it is now. I'm the oldest of three children. Grew up in Brooklyn, New York. My mom, I mean, you're not supposed to say people were alcoholics, but my mom drank more than her share in allotment of alcohol. And consequently, she was a single parent. Never knew my father. Coming from Birmingham, Alabama to Brooklyn. And I grew up in the projects. She didn't know a lot about how to bring up kids. 14, 15 years old, I had to bring up two kids. And my brother came later. You know, in treatment, they have these profiles to try to find out what kind of kid were you, what kind of personality or character you were. And I was basically the class clown, the smartest kid in the class, and the athlete. The athlete, baseball in particular, that's what, those are the three things that I hid behind. Clowning around, keeping people off of me by snapping and cracking jokes and constantly being, you know, diverting attention off of myself onto the other folks. And hiding in the books and getting grades because I wanted to get out of Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn. And I lived in a world of contradiction. Looks like other folks was living certain ways, and we were living certain ways, and I couldn't add, it didn't add up. And then my mom was drinking, and she had these boyfriends, and these boyfriends used to beat her up. And I was like 5, 6, 3, 7, 8, 9. All the guys just always beat up because she was living obviously, I found out later, after joining Alcoholics Anonymous, there's certain things that come with alcoholism. And you know, dishonest lifestyles and cheating on guys or whatever when it went on. So that created a big void of inadequacy with me because I had to protect her, and then I was too small to protect her. And, you know, when the guys at the house, you know, I'm not the man of the house. When the guy leaves, I'm the man of the house. And we grew up on welfare. It was really a ugly set of circumstances. We were exposed to stuff that we shouldn't have been exposed to at that age. My escape was baseball. I played baseball. My first bout of major public humiliation and embarrassment is when I was trying out for the Little League Mets. I was like 6 years old, and I remember they were trying out hitting the ball, you know, in the air and trying to check out your hand and eye coordination. And, you know, guys are lined up, big crowd, and Mr. Walton, my coach, popped the ball up, and I followed the ball, and it hit me on my head. I had a big knot on my head, and I was laying on the bench. It was hot, and they put an ice pack on my head, and the owner of the league came by, and he said, "What's wrong with this kid?" He said, "Oh, he got hit in the head with a popper." He says, "Who hit the ball to him?" He says, "Oh, Mr. Walton." So why would you hit the ball to this kid? He couldn't catch a cold if he slept outdoors all night. It's like everybody heard that, you know? Like, I couldn't catch a cold, let alone a baseball, right? And then my mom comes out there, and she was my greatest fan, but it seemed like she was always drunk. And so I saw what I didn't want to be like when I grew up, and that was an alcoholic. And I saw the patterns, I saw the mannerisms, I saw the unmanageability early. She turned out to be my greatest fan. As I developed and continued to play baseball, I became a real dominant baseball player. And I was in the paper, and it gave me an opportunity to leave the neighborhood and go in an Italian neighborhood where the guys were getting scouted and drafted. And right around this time, in New York was real polarized. The Jewish people live here, the Italians live here, the Koreans and the Asians live here, and the black folks, Jamaicans, Puerto Ricans, and everybody else live in one neighborhood. So it was very polarized, and back then there was a lot of racial stuff going on. Guys getting shot, and the police thought he had a weapon, there was no weapon, and all that kind of stuff. So it was really a lot of tension in Brooklyn back then. And me and Johnny White, the only two black guys on the team, would have to go to Coney Island and Sheepshead Day in Canarsie to play baseball to get the exposure because he's, yeah, this is fast forward. And I was like 12, 13, 14 years old. And they would, the scouts would come out and check us out. But when it would get dark like this, when we had practice, we would have to leave early. And our coach would let four or five guys escort us to the train. Because it was always Vito and Paulie, and those guys would come running from nowhere with bats and chains. I had a couple of near-death experiences where I slipped, got hit in the head with a bottle, and it was stomping me, had a chain, and, you know, my teammates came and got them off. It was really crazy. So, you know, I had three major resentments. The first resentment was with my mom for being an alcoholic and being exposed to that stuff. And then the next resentment was all white folks, you know, and that's the way ignorance is. Ignorance, you know, it used absolute terms like all of them. But I didn't know any better. So all I know is I wanted to play baseball, and then these guys are running after us and all that type of stuff. So I always remember the dusk when the sun's getting ready to go down. You know, my coach O'Brien said, "All right, Merle, White, let's go. It's time for you guys to leave. You know, the lights are coming out. We can't practice at night because we can't get out of the neighborhood at night." The other, you know, thing that I hit in, you know, was academics. And I did pretty well academically in high school. I went to all-boys high school. And like I said, I was a pretty dominant baseball. I got drafted. I was supposed to get drafted in the 8th round in the 11th grade for catching. But I was a dominant pitcher. I was throwing in the 11th grade. I was throwing like 85 miles an hour. And all these people used to come out and see me. I would strike out like 13 guys. I would walk like 8. I was real cocky, had a big mouth. I used to talk a lot of crap to guys on the mound. And, you know, my coach said, "Jesus Christ, throw the damn ball for crying out loud. You're killing me. I'm dying here." You know? And my ego, that was something that I was in total control of. You know, when I was on top of the mound, I finally found my niche. You know what I mean? You can't stop this. And then my mom, in her genius, when I was a junior in high school, when Kansas City Royals, Cleveland Indians, and Montreal Expos, they were bidding who's going to get me and what round and all that type of stuff. My mom is my negotiator while she's drunk, trying to get them to pay for me to go to college because nobody in my family ever went to college. But, you know, back in these days, you didn't go to college. You played, you went to the minor league and played b-ball, and you know, you're back into college later. And it's this lady, you know, this guy, is not going to college. She's either coming with us and playing in Albuquerque, New Mexico. So I had a big resentment with her for negotiating me out of me playing baseball. And I used to always, you know, she was my biggest fan. Even growing up, you know, I remember her being the loudest person in the park when I'm pitching. And, you know, here I am, I'm on a roll. I mean, we strike out like 6, 7, 8 guys in a row. And here she comes. I can't find the plate. I'm walking one guy after the next guy. I can't find the plate. You know, and she would argue with the umpires. Say, hey, the black part of the plate, don't discriminate. That's a part of the plate, too. Call the corners. You know, the corners are part of the plate. You know what I mean? So she knew the game, man. She would argue with the umpires. What kind of call is that? What game are you watching? And all that kind of stuff. So that was my best buddy, though, man. It was like a love-hate relationship with me and my mom. I had to take care of my mom. Flash forward, after she, when I was in high school, I was told by two professors that I couldn't do college work and I needed to play baseball or go to the Navy. And I wasn't academically, I wasn't academic material for college. And I got a 700 on the SAT score, which is like, you know, they get your name and address right, and your social security number, they give you 600. So I got 700. So I believe what they said, that I was not college material, that validated my reason for wanting to play baseball. You know, I'll get paid to do something I like to do. And my mom basically negotiated me out of that deal. And this one guy, Mr. Whittle, Fred Whittle, my world history teacher, he always, you know, I was, you know, class president and stuff like that. He always took interest in me. He said, kid, you're going to do something. There's something about you, kid. You got a spark, kid. I don't know what it is, kid, but there's something about you. You're going to be somebody. And he had me fill out this one application to go to college. And I said, man, Mr. Silver and Mr. Kahn said, I'm not college material. He says, just fill it out anyway. If nothing happens, nothing happens. You can always play baseball. You can always go to the Navy. I said, all right, fill it out. The only application I filled out. And through the affirmative action program, I wound up getting into the school called Hofstra University. And when I got there, that was another culture shock, because a lot of race stuff going on, bananas on your doors, monkeys on your doors, and fraternities, 300 black students, 13,000 white students. So I was in another culture shock type situation. And but I hung out with the guys that, you know, we had to stick together because all the other stuff that was going on. And I hung out, and the studying took off. You know, I studied in groups. Me and these guys used to play ball together, eat together. You know, study together, the whole nine. And I wound up doing pretty good academically. I wound up getting 4 C's in college. Everything else was A's and B's. I graduated with honors. And at the time, I didn't have a real issue. I played baseball for Hofstra, you know, for 2 years, but that was a joke because we're in a division with all scholarships and we had no scholarships. So the law averages, you're paying to get these guys to come in, these guys are getting educated. It was smashing us. So I decided to become a student. And I did well academically, not really, you know, well, let me backtrack. First, 1978, I was 18 years old. It was a long year. My grandmother died. My mom got religion and stopped drinking. My mom had a baby, which is my baby brother. My mom got married to my brother's father. And I was going to college. So all of this happened in 1978. It was like a major year. So I wasn't going to go. I was going to stay home. And my brother's father died 6 weeks after my brother was born. And my brother was on his chest, and he had a stroke and died right there. My brother was like 6 weeks old. So I was going to stay home with my mom. She got religious. And the most important thing is she stopped drinking. She found religion and stopped drinking. So she became a religious, I didn't say fanatic or a freak, but she was really, she was pushing Jesus. Jesus was a big thing. Everywhere you go, Jesus, you can have a conversation, an encounter without the Jesus talk, you know? And I was all right with it. I said, this stuff must really work, you know, wherever Jesus is and all that type of stuff. This is a cool dude because my mom stopped drinking. Then I go to college. I do well academically. I was a part of a lot of groups. I did, you know, I played baseball for 2 years. not really having a problem with new substances. I used to smoke weed and have these deep, profound conversations on, you know, saving the world. And, you know, I took philosophy classes and existentialism and Teilhard and the philosophy of life. And, you know, smoking weed, you have those conversations with your hand, everybody's standing there watching you, and they're waiting for you, and you lose your point. What was I saying? And my, you know, my buddies would say, you were saying, pass, pass, that's what you're saying. So I smoke weed, you know, we used to call them morning joints. Never really, you know, thought I had a problem with weed. Last semester, I was doing well academically, so I got this internship to go to work for this large CPA. I was an accounting major, public accounting major. This large CPA firm, then they extended me a job. So everything's going well. This is a beautiful thing. You know, my brother's like 7, 8 years old. I graduated in 82. I take the CPA exam 5 times in order to become a certified public accountant. And I kept failing by 1, by 2, by 1, by 2. And finally I passed. Then I get this call from Harvard Business School saying that they wanted me to apply to Harvard Business School because my story, growing up in the projects, and my mom and alcohol, I don't know, my father. It was like a great story, you know what I mean? It was like a feature story or something like that. And they wanted me to apply. So I applied. I went up to Harvard, to Cambridge, for a weekend interview. My mom was sick. We thought she had the flu. And when I passed the bar, my mom was so happy. It was deep. She was clean for like 8 years or something like that. And I come back, she's still sick. And, you know, next thing you know, I think it was like March 1st or something like that, we get a call saying she had lung cancer. And she's only 39, right? And this didn't make sense. Oh, I was just shook. That just rocked my world. You know, I was like devastated. And all of a sudden, things stopped making sense again. And my intake of chemicals and alcohol started to increase because I couldn't reconcile, you know, this Jesus thing she was pumping. And I was pissed. I used to ride around smoking other substances. I know we had an AA meeting, but there was some other chemicals involved. And I was ingesting that stuff. And I started drinking heavily because every time I would come down to to what was normal, what seemed to be normal, that was so painful. I hadn't had something to keep me away from it. I stay away from this normalcy. I had to numb myself out. And when they said, man takes a drink, drink takes a drink, then drink takes the man, I was taken. You know, over a period of time of putting those chemicals in my system, the alcoholism kicked in, and next thing I was living off of that stuff. So, fast forward, my mom died. See, I saw her go from 160 pounds to 60 pounds in like about 6 months. And my brother's 8 years old, and I'm like cussing at the Tony, but this is bullshit. I'm like, this God shit, this is bullshit. And I was really upset and angry with God. So, you know, I already had resentment with my mom, and that began to get repaired. Then, you know, then I had resentment with white folks, and now I got resentment with God. So I'm walking around with all of these resentments, and I'm a victim. And I remember my old sponsor, the pledge, used to say, you know, victims don't recover, but they can get a few days clean. You know, you can stay a victim, and you can be clean and not recover. You know, it's be just as crazy and angry and pissed off, you know, but you're clean. You don't have to pick up a white chip, but I wouldn't want to, you know, be in your skin. Needless to say, I was on a self-destructive path after that. You know, the runaway train. I moved down here in 1987. I brought my fiance with me and my brother. So I'm forced to become a parent. I'm 26, I guess, or something like that, and he's like 8. And I'm smoking and drinking and disappearing. You know, the drug log and alcohol. It got really, really out of control. I sent my brother back to New York because my sister didn't think I could handle it until I got secured employment because I had transferred here and lost the job. It was ugly for a good 2 years. It was really ugly. My fiance, you know, thank God for the codependent. I don't know where I would have been without, you know, my enabler, man. You know, she was covering for me and plugging holes and trying to keep the levee, the water from coming in. But eventually the levee busts, like Richard Pryor said, ain't a person in the world can stop no water when they want to go. And and I got overwhelmed. Brought my brother back down here after I secured the job. And they went back up, her and my brother, because my wife couldn't secure a job. She was my fiance at the time. So I'm down here by myself, you know, untreated. Don't realize I have this disease. And I'm trying to figure stuff out. And, you know, I took philosophy courses and all this deep analytical stuff. And I'm taking these chemicals. And I used to sit in these places, these houses, and start talking that woe is me and how, you know, the world is all screwed up. And this is my story. This is my song. You know what I mean? So I would sit there and give them the blues. Hey, man, not right now, man. We'll talk about that, but not right now. You're blowing my high, man. I used to be in the bars, and, you know. And February 9th, 1988 came. My brother was down here, and I forgot my brother. I left my brother in the house. You know, it's like we all have our greatest hits, you know, the worst things you ever done when you were drinking and using, and mine was I left my brother home 3 days, 9 years old. When I came home, he was in the street looking in the cars, looking for his brother. And even today, that's like, you know, it's proof that there's a God. For me to be here and for him to be where he is. Because now he has his story, he has his chips. Because he saw what he didn't want to be like. You know, it was only 2.5, 3 years, but it was enough. It was impressionable enough at that age. So I became King Codependent. Every time he got in trouble, Captain Sabre role. I had to rescue him because I had to, you know, all that stuff that I put him through and him, you know, 3 days, you know, and his things were going, every time he got arrested, alcohol, weed, and car keys. It was all three of those were. He never got in fights. He never stole anything. He never robbed anything. He was really bright academically. Really sounds kind of familiar, right? And he had the gene, but alcohol, car keys, and weed. And now he's, you know, I don't know if he's still, you know, my sponsor says, none of my business. I know he had at least 2 or 3 years, 4 years sober. And now he's, you know, 31, about to become a rap star. He's stuck. I talked to him last night. This man, I'm stuck. It's like time went by fast. I said, I told you it was going to go by fast. I'm 32, man. I don't know what happened. I looked up, you know. But he's doing fine, you know. He's a productive member of society, paying his bills for a change. And I had to go through a Al-Anon moment to cut the umbilical cord, because there was a lot of codependency stuff. I had to rescue him. I was always a savior and a hero and all that type of stuff. And as he got older, it got worse. So then a strange thing happened. And, you know, codependency rides right under alcoholism. It's like this very close first cousin. And I guess alcoholism should be the priority, because that's what got me here. And now, you know, I've been here for a while. I'm able to address some other issues, not directly related to alcoholism, but it's directly related to alcoholism. And that's my inability to say no, my inability sometimes, unwillingness to speak up for myself. You know, my inability to draw a boundary and stop, you know, putting the boundary down for my convenience and put it back up when it's convenient for me and put it back down, you know, that type of stuff. So, I'm one of the founders of the Serenity Club over in Moreland Avenue. The liquor store we converted to a 12-step clubhouse. And we have a men's, this is a shameless plug, we have a men's codependency anonymous meeting called Man Up. And you want to hear some heavy-duty sharing when you take the liquor and the alcohol off the table and you start talking about those causes and conditions and the tears. And it's all men, because they're too much of a punk. You know, they're like little punks with women in it. Oh, I'm fine. Oh, me, I'm fine. Everything. You get them guys up in there, man, like boo-hooing, and next time I'm going to tell them this, and next time, if you say this, I'm going to say that. and they have a little recommendation on, they're telling us how to share, you know. We got double-digit recovery, now everybody becomes newcomers all over again. Like, we don't use terms like they, them, her, she, or him. We start out sharing with I, me, and my. And you can, these guys, 20 years, I feel. It's a journey, man. But you can see that, I mean, it's comical. It was a struggle. We've been doing it for 6 months. But it's really powerful to be able to own, you know, your feelings and speak directly to my feelings. The first 5 years in sobriety, everything was about the dope, about that liquor, the dope, the liquor. Then all of a sudden, that stuff, the system's been gone for quite some time, and I'm still behaving and acting the same way that I was when I got here. You know, stock raving sober, you know. So anyway, that's my plug. That's Wednesday nights at 7:30, guys. Man up! 1933 Moreland Avenue, right directly across the street from the drive-in. And that's a beautiful project. That's one of my favorite, the best thing I think I've ever done. I passed the bar and all that type of stuff. I'll get to that in a minute. But the best thing I think I've done since been in recovery, other than sponsor guys, is become a major part of putting this liquor store. We converted a liquor store to a 12-step clubhouse, which is really powerful. So we have AA and ACA and two CODA meetings there. And that was painstaking. We just need to get the air conditioner on. The air conditioner will be on tomorrow. But anyway, February 9th, 1988 came, and I disappeared for 2 days, and I wasn't a robber, I wasn't, not per se, you know, I ain't go to anybody's house and steal stuff. I prided myself on this. You know, drinking up and smoking up my check. You know, I remember getting on this guy in a crack house talking about smoking up the state refund. I said, you know, you're in the bottom of the barrel and you're smoking up the state refund check. The federal I can see, you know. Set me up, right? The state is only like $117. What are you kidding me? But anyway, that's another meeting. So, February 9th, 1988, I disappeared 3 days. It's something, you know, I was in a meeting in Puerto Rico. I go to this jazz festival every year, and there's a meeting down there. It's the Serenity Club. They have these English-speaking meetings. And this guy says, I don't understand what it is about the 3 days. Every time when I drink alcohol, I go into a blackout and I come back in 3 days. What is it about 3 days? And the little old guy, he says, after 3 days, he rolls! He rolls! I thought that was funny. But anyway. So 3 days, I'm thinking I'm a gigolo. I got this lady's car, and I disappear, and I come back. And the apartment is open. Nobody's in it. And I felt so overwhelmed with guilt and shame that the only thing I could think of is I was looking for a how-to-kill-yourself book, a suicide, how-to suicide book. And I didn't have any of those. I had some philosophy books. And I was looking for, I had this conversation in my head. I said, well, let me go borrow a gun. I'm going to kill myself. I'm going to borrow a gun from the sheriff next door. And then the committee, you know, like, order, order, order. I says, no, you don't want to use the gun. It'll be too loud. It might hurt your ear, right? Right? And that was like an actual thought process. I said, okay, yeah, it'll be too loud. Then I found a big razor. And I cut my arms here, my wrists. Both of my arms and both of my wrists, February 9th, 1988. And I called my wife on the phone, self-pity, oozing out every pore. With the, you know, I'm sorry I spent the rent money. I'm sorry I spent the Christmas money. And, you know, I know I'm nothing what I used to be. And you ain't got to worry about me doing this again. And I put the phone in the blood like, dun-dun-dun, you know what I mean? And she's like, what are you doing? What are you doing? I says, don't worry about it. It's going to be okay. I'm going to leave everybody alone because everything I touch turns to dung. You know what I mean? And so I'm going to get rid of this burden from everybody. And I lay across the bed. In about 15 minutes, you know, still small voice, which I hadn't heard in a long time. Like, what are you doing? Still small voice came in and says, what are you doing? And I'm bleeding, I'm getting cold. And then I was too weak, you know, to try to move or do anything. And that angel, man, the lady that had her brand new car, her brand new Saab, she came in and like, what are you doing, man? Next thing you know, I'm in Georgia Mental Health, and I'm tied up, and I'm strung up, and, you know, and I said, why you got me like, you know, if I'm sick, how can you treat me like a prisoner if I'm sick? You know, I'm in a hospital, and you got me in a handcuff. And I'll never forget it. It was cold, and I was being assessed by three shrinks, and one black guy, a white guy, and a white lady. I think she was a trainee. And so I'm telling them about the story. I'm a self-made man. I'm so smart and bright. I came from the ghetto, and I went to these large schools. And I did get accepted to Harvard, but when my mom got sick, that stuff didn't work as well. I couldn't get to Harvard. And so I told them all this great stuff that I did, and now since I was held up by a tripod of women. You know, one leg was my mother, the other leg was my wife, and the other leg was my sister. My mother died, and the other two couldn't hold me up, so I fell. Boom, right? And I'm looking over at the trainee, the white lady's like, fascinating, fascinating, keep talking, keep talking. She's like, like I'm a specimen or something, you know what I mean? So I looked at the black guy, I said, so that's why you got to get me out of here, brother. You know what I mean? He said, well, that's where you got it wrong, brother. He said, the statistics says the smarter you are, the more chances you are to be insane because you got more information, more questions, and less answers. I'm like, damn. You know what I mean? So I wound up staying in Georgia Mental Health for 7 days, no shoestrings, suicide watch. Got out, changed seats in the Titanic, didn't identify alcohol as my major problem. I was solving symptoms at the time. And I started changing seats, just smoke weed, you know, change seats on the Titanic. The ship is going down, I just want to sit there. Could you move on, please? You know what I mean? and it's going down, and I'm just changing seats. And you would like to say after I got out of treatment, I was fine. But it took me, after the suicide attempt, I was fine, but I wasn't. You know, I found a way to get back to the chemicals again, and it was out of control. June 2nd, 1989 came around. I had already had intervention at Brawner Hospital, and they were talking to me about coming in, and they had a bed for me. I had to wait for my wife to get insurance, and even to this day, she's my ex-wife, and she would say that the only reason I'm sober is because of her insurance. If it wasn't for her, I wouldn't have got sober. It's all right. Everybody has an ego. But anyway, so her insurance should be my higher power. But anyway, so by the grace of God, June 2nd, 1989, I just won another bid, spent $2,500. I was an auditor, right? I was a CPA. I'm auditing books and getting that. We'll give you $5,000. You can pay the rent. I'll go on treatment for 6 months. And then, okay, yo, match made in heaven, right? And I went on a binge and disappeared for 3 days. He rose. And I remember the Thursday before June 9th, my best friend Mike Baker used to go in all kind of traps looking for me. He came and gave me this, and I don't know if this is a relationship or not, he gave me this movie, Less Than Zero, because he was hearing all the stories about me disappearing and spending money and wife can't find me, going in traps looking for me. He said, yo, dude, this is my very best friend in the world. He said, dude, if you don't get your shit together, you're going to be like this dude, right? And this dude of VH, he didn't even want to talk to me. He was like disgusted with me, right? I sat there and watched the movie. I said, oh, shit. Hell no, I'm going to try to get some kind of help from somewhere. But I kept tripping over a dime or $10 or a rocker here and there, a stone. So that from that Thursday, all hell broke loose. Sunday, I get this big money. I give it. I just spent up all this money. Then we go eat at Sadie's in Marietta. And my wife, So I said, you know, Braun is right down the street. She said, get out of here. I said, it's right there in Atlanta Road. They got a nice little camp. She said, you got to be kidding me. Yeah, this is after we ate, right? I didn't see it coming. And she said, I said, yeah, they got a weight room or a pool. She said, get a pool, get out of here, for real. I just told her, I should have known something wasn't right. So we riding down there in Atlanta Road. I said, yeah, we should fly past. You can just, like, peep in there. You can see it. But they don't have any rooms. They don't have any beds or anything. She said, oh, really? So we get to the entrance, and she turns in, and it's like, dun-dun-dun. The doctors are like, come on in, come on in, come on in. And obviously, she had already called them and had me set up. So I went in there like dog day afternoon. Like, this has to work. You know what I mean? Midnight Express. It doesn't stop here, right? So I met Dr. Gordon, and since then, I haven't found it necessary to use or drink any chemicals. There's probably some behavior stuff I could qualify for a white chair with some attitudes and behaviors and ideas. And it's been a wonderful ride. I strongly believe in working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I strongly believe in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 and 12. I sponsor too many guys. I've got about 17, 18, 19 guys that I sponsor. But it doesn't become as much of a burden because I sponsor them to sponsor other men to sponsor other men. So once they hear themselves coming back at them, they sort of leave me alone. Call you, don't drink, go to meetings and call your sponsee. That'll keep me clean for another day. Listen to this guy, you know what I mean? I'm one of the founders of the heavy hitters group, Alcoholics Anonymous, the original nine. And the founder of the heavy hitters retreat that we do every year. We've got years 15 coming up. And I've been an instrument. I understand the day that my job is I get clean, clear some stuff out, make room so I can give some stuff away. Usually when I'm screwed up in the head and I'm crazy and stuff like that, it's me. Usually I'm bumping into myself. So that's why I have to go to meetings. I come to meetings to sort things out, put things back into perspective. Because out there, man, it can get real confusing real fast, you know. I really believe in the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I try to do this in 5 to 7 minutes, but I added this to my story because some people will never, you know, we hear steps thrown around in the meetings, but nobody, you know, you really don't see too many people, depending on what meetings you go to, who actually applying them and working, explaining. So I go to a lot of 12 and 12 meetings. I've met my sponsor in the 12 and 12 meeting, and, you know, steps one, for me, came out of the big book, you know, listening to Dr. Silkworth and telling my story, doing stuff like this, being a channel to help another man, and telling my story and recognize my unmanageability and my powerlessness. And Dr. Silkworth said it's all physical. Just don't put no chemicals in, period. Don't put no chemicals in, period. Don't put no, period. Let's say don't put no chemicals in, period. Because the disease, you know, I have this allergy. You know, and once these chemicals get in, all bets are off. I can't make reasonable decisions on my own anymore once these chemicals are in my system. And step two, I had a major problem with God. So my problem with God was my mom died at 39, left my brother at 7 to 8, and I was 26. It was really ugly, so I had a big resentment with God. So it took me a couple of years to be okay with the higher power thing. So I just did the group as my higher power. My sponsor is my higher power. I just did the substitute higher power thing until I actually saw it. Usually, I think what happened, I saw it working in your life, and I started, you know, parallel parking, backing into the higher power thing. Because I didn't really, you know, because my mom was a Jesus freak, and I said, look what Jesus did to you. This is what Jesus does, stuff like this. If this is Jesus' work, I don't want it, you know. And I was real bitter. But I had to learn to forgive and you know, life, I believe in karma. I believe in the energy field of the universe. That's the 8th, 9th step. I talk about that in a minute. But, this, you know, the second step, I had to get some power. Because obviously I didn't have any power on my own the way I was functioning, the way I was operating. I was smart, and I was bright, and I was intelligent, and I could take tests. But that wasn't power. You know what I mean? There's only one, what do you say? There's only one God, and you find him now. So I had to back into the second step. And what's strange about the second step is, you know, my sponsor plans again, who died about 15 years ago, used to say, after you put the plug in the jug and once you retire the pipe or whatever your symptom is, 90% of this is second step stuff, relating myself to a higher power. Is my ego up? Is the ego up day or is the ego down day? You know, who you think you're talking to? No, you don't know who he's talking to. You know what I mean? So I have to sort of like gauge myself where my ego is. Is God in today? Is this a God day? Is this my day? Am I back in charge again? And that made a lot of sense to me, you know. So second step is really important. And the other thing that's significant about the second step is if I don't get it, I can just check not applicable for the remaining steps because I don't have a higher power, so I don't have anybody to, you know, I don't have anything to turn my will and my life over to. I don't have anything to remove my defects and my shortcomings. I don't have anything to pray to, you know what I mean? I don't have any meditation. I don't have anything, you know. I'm powerless. So I get some power in the second step. In the third step, I get a chance to turn my will and my life over. And that was like a weed conversation, smoking weed, life, and my will, and turning it over. But I didn't let it go, and all that type of stuff. You know, deep, profound, philosophical discussion. And my sponsor said that basically working the third step is the act of faith. The person behind the third step is faith. And you walk faith. You don't talk faith. It's not a discussion. And if you want to walk and show that you have faith, work 4 through 9. So now I'm in the game. He gets me the pen and paper. And then I knew the story, so the fourth step wasn't my problem. The fifth step was my problem, having to disclose this to another human being. Now, I can talk to God, but I don't want to talk to you. You know, that's how wishy-washy. And even today, I can get wishy-washy, you know, because the ego up or ego down, you know what I mean? And I did, you know, I wrote down the resentment, fears, sexual problems, and I disclosed it. Because I didn't trust you guys, I stepped outside the program and went to the monastery in Conyers and spoke to Father Damien. And Father Damien had 38 years clean at the time. He had his knuckles was cut off. He used to be a mobster in Chicago. And so I'm sitting there and I'm trying to, you know, respect the environment because it's real spiritual. And, you know, you got the monks walking around. And, you know what I mean? So I'm trying not to cuss like I'm tonight, right? I'm trying not to cuss. So at the P word, when I was reading the P word, I would say vagina. The F word, I would say intercourse. You know, cleaning them up my act, you know, doing my fish check with Father Damien. And then he looked like he's half asleep. He's turning to the left, turning to the right. 3.5 hours later, he said, "You finished?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "So fucking what? Welcome to the real fucking world." He said, "That should have killed you, man. That should have killed you." He said, that was a sick kid. You see them, what you got in those papers? That'll kill you. That should have killed you. He says, "There's 4 things I want you to remember. 1, admit that you did those things. 2, have some remorse for having done them. 3, try not to do them again. And 4, if you do them again, get back in recovery as soon as you can." And I was like, the air came out of the balloon, man. You're talking about the pink cloud. It was like unbelievable. That was like an instant hit. It was like that hit, that blast I was looking for. You know what I mean? So now, I'm thinking my problems are over, so I go to 6 and 7. And 6 and 7 was explained to me, you know, that was another deep, profound intellectual step as far as I was concerned, and I had to get it broken because smart people, we need stuff broken down. You know, we need to break it down to us. So he says, "Well, defects." I said, "What's the difference between defects and shortcomings?" He said, "Well, defects are things you do that you should not be doing." I said, "Okay, I can buy that." "Shortcomings are things that you should not be doing that you do. You come up short. The things you should be doing that you don't do." So he says, "So if you stop doing the things that you shouldn't be doing, you have time to do the things you should be doing." It's like, yeah, right over my head. So instead of working on, you know, I didn't put the defects there, I can't remove them. So I asked the higher power to remove them. He said, "You don't have to move them." I said, "I'm working on my lust." He says, "Nah, you work on your, whatever you work on is going to get bigger. If I work on my resentments get bigger. So I work on forgiveness." You know, work the opposite of the defect or the shortcoming. That's how I help the higher power. I ask him to remove it, and I work on the opposite. That worked for me. That was like a mathematical formula to a smart guy like me. Yeah, I can do that. I can do that. So 6 and 7 went by, and then I got to 8 and 9, and that was tough because I'm thinking I'll have to say my bad, sorry about that, you know, that type of thing. And my sponsor had me write down a list. It was 3 lists: the people I can make amends to, the people I'm not sure if I can make amends to, and the people I know I cannot make amends to. So I had to do substitute amends for people that were already gone. And then it was always the mixed group. I had identified a harm. All that's in the 12 and 12. We have the instructions, and it worked. But the only thing that pissed me off, I had to write checks and replace VCRs and TVs and stuff like that, because that stuff was gone, and I had to replace them. The amends is not my bad. The amends is cut a check and put it back where you found it. Like my mom said, where did you find that? Put it back where you got it. And I had to fix some things, you know, amend it. And after the ninth step, and I continue to do nine steps. Well, I try not to continue to do nine steps. That's why I try to do the 10th step properly. And the 10th step is my thermometer. The 10th step tells me whether or not I'm on point. You know, how soon am I making my amends? Am I waiting three weeks where it sets itself up to get on a four-step list, your resentment list, or am I promptly making the amends? And the other thing about the 10th step is significant for me is the 10th step works immediately. It's like the first step works immediately. You don't put nothing in, it may not get better, but it won't get worse, guaranteed. It may not get better. If you knew, this might sound like a bunch of garbage, but if you don't put nothing in, it won't get worse, guaranteed. Guaranteed. It may not get better in the immediate future, but it won't get worse. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to stop the pain. And the 10th step allowed me to do that. You know, there's a, I'm going to wrap it up. There's a one of my favorite passages in the book. When the second step is, you know, therefore we remain self-deceived and incapable of being restored to sanity. That's pretty deep. Because if I can't be restored to sanity, no. Therefore we remain so incapable of being restored to sanity, of receiving enough grace to be restored to sanity. Yeah. And grace is free. And that's really bad if you can't receive grace. We're going to get this thing. We're going to get this thing. No. You know, I'm so close. No, I want a good life. Come on. I don't deserve it. You know, I refuse to receive grace. That's deep. And then the other, one of my other favorite passages is on page 53 in the 12 and 12. Where it says, it's with our twisted relations with family and friends that many of us suffered the most, we've been particularly stupid and stubborn about them. You know, and that's what my family is. This is a lot of stupid and stubborn stuff. Watch the holidays. That's why when the holidays come, the order for white chips, regardless of what fellowship you're in, quadruple. Something happens from Thanksgiving to New Year's. Because people gotta get around their family and start talking to stealing stuff, you know. And we take off. I'm out of here. I don't have to listen to this. And I remember that. And I have an uncle even today, 22 years sober, Thanksgiving. He'll look at me and say, I know you got my goddamn VCR. The jury's still out on you. You going there talking all that age shit, yo? You don't want to hear that amends, you know? That's that age shit. I need my damn VCR. You know? So the 10th step is really important because there's a passage, one of the most important tools that I use to get me through, especially when I have an encounter with another human being. And I'm pretty good by myself, but when I have an encounter, a conflict with another human being, it says, all people, on page 91, all people, including ourselves, are emotionally ill as well as frequently wrong. All people, comma, including ourselves. Because obviously Bill knows we don't think we're part of all people, right? I thought he was saying y'all people are emotionally ill as well as frequently wrong. Then we find out what true tolerance and love for our fellow man actually means. It becomes pointless to allow ourselves to become hurt by people who are like us, who are suffering from the pains of growing up. That's 100%. That's pure. That's pure. All people are struggling. Everybody has this story, you know, and that gets me out of the judgment game, because once I come up with an opinion and I start judging, I'm in trouble, because I'm stepping out of the spiritual realm. I'm back, ego up, you know what I mean? So I love the 10th step. The 11th step, you know, I had to go out and get some materials to learn how to sit still. I have photographic memory. And trying to be still and meditate, it took a long time for me to get settled. And you know, I started out, thinking that I had to out-meditate you. It was like, remind me of back in the day we used to smoke weed. I out-meditated, I'm deeper than he is. And then I find out today in my meditation, I need 10, 15 minutes usually. But the purpose of meditation is just to get settled. You got it? click, press send, let's go. You know? But I want to sit there, home. You know what I mean? An hour and a half. That's where I started. I wanted, it's something about quantifying and adding more, you know? And it turns out, it's, you know, less is more, you know? Less is more. Just try to get to where you get to, need to get to and move on. And the 12th step is my life. I live the 12th step. I am the 12th step. I believe in, I know now that my job is to give back. I receive so I can give. You know, I passed the bar in 1993. I'm self-employed. I had all these crack houses. I used to have these crack houses, rental properties. They thought I was the Donald Trump of crack houses, right? So my job is to get improved problems. If I don't want problems, I might be in the wrong room. I was always taught that my job is to get better problems, you know, better problems and higher quality problems. So I'm real grateful, man, to have the opportunity, because I have had a spiritual awakening, and I know how it works. So that's why it's important for me to continue to come around here, regardless of how much 22 years, you know, Tim was talking about 4 years, man. 4 years is a long time. That first 4 years is hell. That first 5 years, man, you couldn't, you know, you're talking about ego up, ego down, ego up, you know, and being around here for a while, the complacency can kick in. So I always try to keep me a newcomer, man. Give me somebody under a year to keep it green for me and keep it fresh. Because this is a gift, man. This is a whole lot of people out there now trying to figure it out. I got to get out of here. You know, I've been there for day two. Remember day two? You still here? That kind of stuff. So I'm really grateful to have an opportunity to share my story with you guys tonight, man. And that's my story. I'm sticking to it. Thanks for letting me share.
Okay, who joins me in saying that they got enough power tonight to make it without taking a drink? Thank you, Mel. And if you got about 90% of that and 10% went like that, you go to NevaClub.org next week and you'll be able to hear it again. And I've asked Sam Alexander to hand out the chips.
Good evening, my name is Sam, I'm an alcoholic. And here at NAVIP, at Monday Night Blue Chip Speaker of Alcoholics Anonymous, we have a chip system, a white chip if you're just coming in and just coming back. Is there anyone here this evening who would like to pick up a white chip, sign a surrender, just coming back? Have a desire not to drink today? All right. Is there anyone here celebrating 30 days of continuous sobriety? All right. Anybody celebrating 90 days that the judge didn't give you? Is anyone celebrating 6 months in a row? How about 9 months of continuous sobriety? Okay, how about a year or more? All right. Oh, we have another one.
How many? What's your first name?
I'm Sally, I'm an alcoholic.
Thank you. By God's grace and mercy, to come and keep. Have a kind of people to drink the blood.
All right, now it's my turn for my story. I've been another 3 hours. Seriously, I didn't do this by myself. I didn't even think this was going to happen. And to be honest with you, Mel even saw me when I had day 17. I remember I was at Triangle Club and went to a meeting. I heard him speak something after me. And it's like, man, I really like what you said. I don't know what the hell you said, but I liked it. He was like, how much time you got? I said, 17 days. He was just like, oh, snap. And he yelled, and like about 8 of the guys came over there, so I was ready to fight. And that's not what happened. What has happened is that we got our home group. My home group is Heavy Hitters Men's Group. We got a sponsor, and I was shown that just do this. I didn't trust the God. I trust this process and trust y'all. And somewhere in the midst of that, the God used to be to whom it concerned. Now it is God. And I one thing I know is that early on I was hoping that this would work. I was hoping that, I hope I don't drink today. And hope I don't sit two elbows up and do overhead welding. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, you don't know. But if you do know what I'm talking about, you know. And today, I got faith. In other words, I know that this works. It's completely different. And I can only keep what I have by giving it away. Tim.
Is there anyone here who would like to reconsider on the white chip? All right, congratulations on the chips you hold. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
Okay, anybody have a quick announcement, AA-related announcement?
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Melbourne Alcohol.
Sure.
Friday night at 6 o'clock, the Reset Group, all delete group of Alcoholics Anonymous.
The Reset Group. It's a 12 and 12 meeting. Control, Alt, Delete group of Alcoholics Anonymous meets at the Sorority Club, 1933 Moreland Avenue, right across the street from the drive-in. And also, later on that evening at 10 o'clock, we have a co-ed candlelight meeting called the Soft Touch, the Soft and Heavy Group. Soft Touch female group plus the Heavy Hitters group. We have a co-ed candlelight meeting on Fridays at 10 o'clock. Candlelight, thanks.
Thank you, Mel. Next week, we've got Michael J., who's celebrating 2 years. He's with Complete Abandoned Group, and he's a regular. He's not here tonight, but he's usually sitting right over there. So he'll be back here Monday to tell his story for the first time at NAVA. And then the week after that, Joy W. of We Are Not a Glum Lot Group. That meets on Thursday nights at 8 o'clock at the Dunwoody United Methodist Church. So we got two fine speakers coming up for you. And if there's nothing else, I'd just like to remind you that anonymity is... I forgot what I'm supposed to say. Somebody help me. All our affairs... ever reminding us Christ's principles before personalities and intelligence. For those who will, please join us in the Lord's Prayer. Kia, would you take us up?
Sure. Just a moment of silence for those still sick and suffering inside and outside these rooms. Who woke us up this morning?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory. Forever and ever. Amen. Keep coming back
if you work. Hey, Mark. Mark will be signing papers in the front of the room. Just a second. Again, I don't know. Well, Mark? Well, hey, Clay, would you mind signing?
No.
Thank you.